This episode in the life of Jesus comes about halfway through his ministry. And if we look from that mountaintop right in the middle of the Gospels, if we look back, we can see the Jordan. We can see the place where he was baptized. We can see the place where he first heard that voice that said to him, "You are my beloved Son, in whom I take delight." A little bit further away, we can see the desert. The desert where he went just after his baptism, and where he was tempted. And the temptations were this. The tempter says to him, "If you are the Son of God, then use this power for yourself. If you're the Son of God, then you can make these stones into bread and you won't be hungry anymore. What's the point of being Son of God if you don't use your power? If you are the Son of God," says the tempter, "then throw yourself down from the pinnacle of the temple and see how many armies of angels God sends to protect you, to bear you up. What's the point of being Son of God if that's what you really are? What's the point of being Son of God if you haven't got armies of angels at your beck and call to save you?" But returning to this mountain, it's like chapter 2, if you like, in the story of the Son of God. First down there in the baptism in the desert, then up here on the mountain. And from this mountain you can also see further across into Jerusalem to another hill, the third moment of the sun. We see the glory, the transfigured Jesus. This is the kind of glory that we're used to. This is glory with bling. This is whiz-bang, bright light, lots of show glory. Although strangely, there are only three people there to witness it. But the glory on the mountaintop is a theme we're used to from the Hebrew Bible. And Moses, who encountered God on the top of Mount Sinai and received the Torah, Moses is there. Elijah, who encountered God on the Mount of Horeb, he's also there. And Jesus is looking glorious. His face bright as the sun, his clothes dazzlingly white. This is what we think of as glory. This is a theophany. But the strangest thing is, when these three disciples come down the mountain with Jesus, he says, "Don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone until," he says, "the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. Don't tell anyone yet, because you haven't understood what glory is. You still think like most of us still think, like most of our world still thinks, that glory is about bling. The glory is about magnificence. The glory is about outshining all the others. The glory is about being on the top." Implicitly, Jesus is saying to them, "You will not understand what divine glory is until you have seen this third mountain." This hardly gets called a mountain, the hill of Golgotha. You won't have understood what the glory of God is revealed in Jesus until you've seen Act 3. Transfiguration is one thing, but to be disfigured as he was on Calvary seems quite the opposite. But the Gospels are telling us that if we only think of transfiguration and bling and whiz-bang shows of glory, then we are still thinking in a human way. We have not yet come to believing in the God who is revealed in Jesus Christ. In John's Gospel, Jesus refers to that moment on Calvary, there in Jerusalem, as his hour of glory. The hour when he is at his lowest in worldly terms. The hour when he has no glory. There are no angels coming to save him. There are no even crowds of his own poor followers are not there to protect him. They've all run away. They've denied him. They've betrayed him. They've abandoned him. And yet he calls it his hour of glory. Because God's glory is not glory as we think of it. God's glory is seen in the crucified one. Yes, it's really God's glory. This is kind of the temporary message of the transfiguration. Transfigured so everyone knows who they're dealing with, right? Son of God. But the essence of that glory will only be seen in the cross. The essence of that glory will only be seen in the pouring oneself out in humility, will only be seen in the identifying with the outcast, with the unjustly accused, with the mistreated, with the downtrodden. That's the glory of God. That's the wonder of God. That's the wonder of the gospel. It's not the wonder of the gospel that we say, oh, we've got such a huge God, he's better than all the other gods. He's full of bling, he can do anything. He's bigger than any of our powers. God is not interested in any of that. God is not in competition with us for who can put on the biggest show of power and strength, who has the biggest armies, who has the most money, who has the most control over the most people. God refuses to play that game, and he points us to the crucified one. To the transfigured one, yes, but to the disfigured one even more. To the disfigured one who has brought the glory of God right into the heart of human God-forsakenness, right into the heart of human need, right into the heart of the frailty that we all experience, right into the heart of the worst that human beings can do to one another. That's the wonder of the gospel. Not that we've got a big God, but we have a God whose real glory, whose real delight is to share our lot, to be near us, to share our humanity. And the voice from the cloud, the voice of God says to them, listen to him. Now it may be, if God had read a bit ahead in Matthew's Gospel, he would have seen all the things that Jesus was still going to say. If he read ahead in Mark's Gospel, Jesus wouldn't have said very much after the transfiguration. But it's what he says in his flesh that we need to listen to. Okay, his words are important. Fine. No one's denying that. But we are people of the incarnation. We're not people simply of the words in red ink. We are people who believe that God speaks to us in the flesh. And in the flesh, particularly in the flesh that has been pierced, particularly in the flesh that has been abandoned and shared our fleshly life. So what does it mean for us to listen to what he says? How do you listen to a word made flesh? How do you know whether you're even hearing the word made flesh? You hear the word made flesh in your own flesh. We hear the word made flesh in the body of the church. We hear the word made flesh. We resonate with the word made flesh and what it is saying, what it is revealing in our own flesh. It's nonsense to just keep repeating the name of Jesus, but not to take the shape of Jesus in our own flesh, because talk is so cheap. Yes, we can throw his name around, and we do. We call ourselves Christians, we call ourselves Jesus people. But if we are really his disciples, if we are really listeners to him, if we are really resonating with the word made flesh, then our flesh, our bodies are going to start to look like his. They're going to be placed where his is. They're going to be placed with the outcast. They're going to be bearing injustice rather than giving it back. They're going to be accepting outrages and forgiving rather than taking revenge. To hear what he has to say as the Father has bidden us means hearing it in our skin and bones, in our flesh and bones. And that, if we were to do it as individuals, as church, that would be the day when all the nations would bless themselves by us, as God said to Abraham. Our name of church will be a blessing for the whole world, and on the day when we live his life in our own flesh, when we live his humility, his self-giving, his self-sacrifice in our own flesh. And he welcomes us into that body, into that flesh, so that we too might be conformed to him. He welcomes us here to this table and says to us, "This is my body for you. Take, eat, become part of my body." It will take us not just to the heights of glory with flashy bling on mountaintops. It will take us to the distant Jerusalem and the hill of Golgotha. But the promise is that this is truly to enter into the heart of God, to enter into resurrected life, to enter into the fullness of life with the God proclaimed to us, revealed to us in Jesus Christ.